Today we will do a Veterans Day study. The title of it is Kabanatuan, Jesus Christ Controls History. It is a Veterans Day special, and today actually is Veterans Day, falling on this Sunday. In order to prepare for this study, we will pause for a few moments of silent prayer, affording you the opportunity to utilize the privacy of your priesthood for a rebound if necessary. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we are indeed grateful to you for the honor and privilege of gathering here today on this holiday that commemorates the service to this country by those who have gone before in the service and in the conflict and its wars. We thank you for these individuals, some of them who have given the greatest service of all, the sacrifice of their very lives in the defense of our freedoms. These individuals have served. Many of them volunteered. All of them did it so that we might be free. Today, therefore, Father, we salute those who have gone before in the service of the colors, and it is our prayer that what we note this morning, this one vignette from all of these conflicts, will inspire us to appreciate the veterans of this country and Jesus Christ, who is their commander-in-chief. To these things we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. One of the most dramatic events in U.S. military history occurred near the close of World War II. It involved the rescue of 510 prisoners of war who were held by the Japanese at Camp Kabanatuan, 4 miles north of Kabanatuan City and a mile south of Kabul. I'll give you a map. I guess we may as well get started with our visuals. This is the island of Luzon, the major and largest island in the Philippine archipelago. You will note that right here is Manila at this point, and northeast is Kabanatuan. And this was a major prison camp for the Japanese during the Second World War. The site was one of three actual camps, major camps, that the Japanese had to house POWs that were captured at Bataan, in the Bataan Peninsula, actually. These were individuals who were caught as the American and Philippine forces were backed down to the end of the peninsula, and the famed Bataan Death March began along here. When the Americans and Filipinos surrendered, there were 70,000 approximately at the very beginning, and the 55-mile march took almost a week, and along that route, 7,000 to 10,000 were either executed or died from various reasons. About 6,000 to 7,000 escaped into the jungles of Bataan and the Philippines. The death march, therefore, was a forced march from Mariveles on the southern tip of the peninsula northward 55 miles to Camp O'Donnell in Tarlac Province in central Luzon. Of 70,000 prisoners, only 54,000 reached the camp. An estimated 7 to 10 died on the way, the rest captured, and therefore some escaped into the jungles of Luzon Island. Later, some were removed from Camp O'Donnell to Puerto Princesa on Palawan Island, south of Bataan, in the South China Sea. When American forces returned to the Philippines in December of 1945, the High Command in Tokyo issued orders to liquidate the prisoners at Palawan. On December 15th, 150 men were forced into underground bomb shelters and burned alive. Only 11 escaped. Other Bataan survivors were transferred to Camp Kabanatuan in Nueva Ecija Province in the east. Systematically, over the 3 years between the end of the Bataan campaign in April of 1942 and the return of U.S. forces in December of 1944. Thousands of prisoners were removed to Japan and placed into forced labor while being held in some 150 camps there. Other less well-known prison camps were spread all over the Western Pacific. 21 others in the Philippines, 28 in Sumatra, 16 in Formosa, known today as Taiwan, 15 in Java, 14 in the Dutch East Indies, 10 in Korea, 9 in the Philippine Islands other than Luzon, and a few more scattered among other islands. By the time of the American invasion of Luzon in December 1944, only a little more than 500 remained alive on the island of the original 70,000. They were being held at Cabanatuan and were scheduled for execution as the Japanese army began its retreat to the north. The initial target for the American forces was Manila, the capital of the archipelago, and American troops went ashore at Lingayen Gulf on January 9th of 1945. U.S. General Douglas MacArthur had fulfilled his promise to return to the Philippines following the defeat 3 years earlier at Bataan. His forces numbered 280,000 troops, whose mission was to take on General Tomoyuki Yamashita's 250,000-man army. Once ashore, it was realized that Yamashita had chosen not to join the battle, but at the time had retreated to the mountains to the north. MacArthur therefore made the decision to take Manila, which was on the eastern shore of the bay, or the gulf as it were, and then organized for pursuit of Yamashita to the north. In charge of the Manila campaign was General Walter Kruger, who was in command of the 6th Army. On January 26th, the General Kruger was advised that 60 miles to the northeast, over 500 American prisoners of war were being held at Camp Cabanatuan, and that as the Americans moved northward, there was a distinct possibility that Japanese would execute them. Advising the general was Robert Lapham, an American guerrilla, who was leader of the Filipino insurgents. In the course of the last 3 years, over 8,000 men had gone through the camp at Cabanatuan, but thousands had been removed to join work details in Japan. Now only the very weak and sickly remained, and they were surely to be eliminated within the next few days. Now, complicating the task of trying to rescue these men was the fact that over 8,000 Japanese troops were concentrated between American lines some 30 miles northeast of Lingayen Gulf and Cabanatuan City, 30 miles further. So there was a mission underhand, and it was suggested that these men be rescued. The mission before Kruger then was the defeat of the Japanese army, which began by the taking of Manila. The discussion had to do with whether or not it was wise to take the time and the troops to go save these men who were already near death and were certainly going to be executed, where the major concept and the major drive, the major intent was to capture Luzon Island. However, General Kruger realized he had to do something to rescue the men at Cabanatuan. He decided that the best men available were the 6th Ranger Battalion under the command of Lieutenant Henry Musi, an officer whose flamboyant personality and omnipresent pipe had earned him the nickname of Little MacArthur. In April of 1944, Musi was given the assignment of organizing an infantry battalion, and he took it with gusto, training his men in the fashion of Colonel William O. Darby, who organized the 1st Ranger Battalion in 1942 and participated with the Big Red One in the invasion of North Africa. Musi conducted arduous training of his men that concluded with climbing Pike's Peak with pack mules. At Port Moresby, New Guinea, where the Allied forces had a base, Musi's training intensified. He gave instruction in hand-to-hand combat, night warfare, jungle survival techniques, and amphibious exercises. He forced men to run up a hill, which they called some name I can't repeat here, but he forced them to run up the hill on one leg. And then when they achieved the top, they would have come down on the other leg. And then, having completed the course, they were then to knock down the man beside them. He constantly ran the men to the point of physical exhaustion. Most of the Rangers had never seen significant action, but all were in excellent physical condition, well prepared to do night assaults and knowledge of how to operate in stealth. Musi didn't need all 800 of his men, so he chose C Company under the command of Captain Robert Prince, a Stanford graduate who was a brilliant tactician and who, in stark contrast to Musi, had a very low-key personality. It was Musi's job to motivate the men for the mission. It was Prince's to pull it off under Musi's guidance. In addition, Musi selected Company F under the command of First Lieutenant John Murphy, two teams of Alamo scouts, and four combat photographers. Total strength of his force was 8 officers and 120 enlisted men. The mission was to move undetected for 60 miles, the first 30 by transports, the last 30 on foot. Early in the morning of January 28th, the Rangers' convoy reached Gemba, which sat on the edge of the American lines, and where they continued the mission on foot. From there to Cabanatuan, it was a 30-mile walk and then 30 back, the latter with hopefully over 500 freed but sickly ex-POWs. Have a map that shows these areas. This is the target at Gemba, and they will move from Gemba along this dotted line, which we will examine in our study. It's the solid line. This is the ingress. The dotted line is the egress. They're left from Gemba, and they move through Lobong, which is a barrio. They followed this route here, and we'll examine it in a bit of detail this morning. Platero became the base of operations for the raid as they moved down into the area of the prison camp. I'll leave this up as we'll note some of these points later on. Now, what lay ahead then was a 12-mile march over countryside, bisected by roads patrolled by the Japanese, bridges that were held by their tanks, the danger of just one Filipino spy leaking their presence to the enemy based in Cabanatuan City. To guard their secrecy and the supreme importance of protecting the element of surprise once at the camp, Musi ordered complete radio silence. The Rangers were armed with a variety of weapons: M1 Garand rifles, M1 carbines, Thompson machine guns, Browning automatic rifles, Colt 45s, bazookas, and fragmentation grenades. The Rangers were armed with a variety of weapons, and therefore they were going to lug these over this trek of ground while remaining silent and undetected. And so they headed out for Gemba, choosing to cross open fields rather than use the highways. Their first stop was the barrio of Lobong, where they linked up with Eduardo Hosan, the leader of 80 Filipino guerrillas who were to assist the Rangers in this raid. You can see that Lobong is right here, and this is as they leave Gemba. This is their first stop right here, and they take in some Filipino guerrillas at this point. These guerrillas had developed after the Japanese invaded the Philippines several years before. And the Philippines were brutalized by the Japanese. They would often raid their cities if anyone in that city was discovered to be a guerrilla. And they would execute just innocent citizens within that city in order to discourage guerrilla operations. So we have this man named Hosan who heads up this first guerrilla segment. Hosan was well known to Major Lapham. The man had detailed knowledge of the terrain, as did his guerrillas. They were volunteers who had engaged the Japanese in ambushes and raids for over 3 years. The American-Filipino relationship was one of mutual respect. The Filipinos were not exactly happy with the presence of any foreigners in their islands, but they shared a mutual dislike for the Japanese. Both had endured horrible physical abuse and murderous treatment from the Japanese Imperial Army, and the idea of springing the American POW was right down the guerrillas' alley. That afternoon, the two groups moved out as one. You have men now totaling over 200, and they soon entered into the dense forest which preceded them, which once traversed surrendered to fields of tall grass. Soon they met their first challenge. The fields were dissected by the Talavera Highway, one of Luzon's major north-south thoroughfares, and on arrival it was discovered that the Japanese were in process of moving men and equipment northward in retreat. Now, this map does not show Talavera, but this is the, I think Talavera is located somewhere along here. This is the highway they had to cross, and this is the one that presented a great challenge. You will note as they come here, they're able to get across and move down, and there's another highway to cross later on. But during this process, they ran into a number of challenges. And I found it interesting as I was reading my major resource, which is Hampton Sides' Ghost Soldiers, that on so many of the occasions, the American and Filipino forces should have been discovered. This is a thread that runs throughout the entire episode. But on every occasion, we have divine intervention, the concept that Jesus Christ controls history. These men had been held as prisoners of war, brutalized to the point of complete physical exhaustion. Every one of them suffered from some kind of illness, from malnutrition, if not from anything else. And therefore, the Filipinos wanted to help the Americans rescue these men, and obviously the Lord did too. There are so many examples of how these forces should have been discovered, but were not. And the excitement of the battle itself and the denouement is something that will give you recognition of the fact that Jesus Christ is indeed the Lord of the armies. They traveled, therefore, at night to avoid detection by American aircraft, that's the Japanese. But their presence created an unforeseen delay in reaching Cabanatuan. So when they got to this highway here, this entire highway at night was filled with a Japanese convoy heading north. And therefore, they were stymied. They had to stop. Now, the mission is to get to Cabanatuan before the men are executed. And the process that they used to do this is they would force the men to build trenches that were about 4 to 5 feet deep, and then cover these trenches with lumber and logs. And they said to the men that these were air raid shelters. And then on occasion, they would say, you have to get into these trenches because there's an air raid. And once they got them in there, then they would unload 55-gallon drums of gasoline, pour it in the trenches, and then set them on fire. That's what happened earlier at that other island I mentioned. Now, Musi, therefore, on this occasion, decided to wait until the traffic subsided, and as soon as the road was clear, he began to move troops across two at a time. But only about half the men had made it to the other side when Musi suddenly noticed a tank parked about 100 yards north, its turret pointed right at them. So you've got a tank 100 miles north, and men have been going across the highway two at a time for about 30 minutes. And suddenly it's noticed. This was the first in a long series of events that threatened exposure of the mission to the Japanese. It was also the first event in which divine protection blinded the eyes of the enemy. The Air Corps had provided the Rangers with aerial photographs, and Musi and Prince used them to locate a ravine that crossed by a bridge in the vicinity of the tank's location. In other words, what you had is a bridge here, and you have a stream running underneath and a ravine. And they noticed this in the aerial photographs, and they decided that the last half of the men would come down and they would go underneath this bridge to the other side. It turned out that this tank was not near the bridge. It was on the bridge. And so they had a definite problem here. So it was decided, however, that the remainder of the troops would have to move to this ravine and sneak under the bridge. Once they arrived, they found the tank parked right in the middle of it. Its operators, however, were inside. As the men moved quietly, one by one, under the bridge, they could hear the men talking inside the tank. It took 30 minutes to get every man across, and they then reunited with the others in a rice paddy. Now, just past midnight, January 29th, the Rangers crossed a field of tall grass called kogon, used for thatching and fodder, but with a sticky substance on its blades that caused the Ranger's skin to itch. Next, they crossed the Talavera River and resumed their trek through the kogon and the dangers of the darkness. Krait, the venomous elapidae of the Philippines, cockroaches the size of mice, feral dogs, wild boars. The Filipinos were unnerved since they believed that demons called aswangs lived in the kogon grass. Unmolested by either beasts or demons, the Rangers arrived the next morning at Balincaran, a barrio 5 miles north of Cabanatuan. The village had just the week before suffered an attack by the Japanese because it was suspected of harboring guerrillas, and over 100 of its residents had been killed. Musi was shocked to learn that the people of Balincaran knew of his arrival ahead of time and feared his prized secret mission was now out in the open. However, news traveled fast among the Filipinos by what the Americans called the bamboo telegraph. All knew of the mission, and all knew to keep what they knew to themselves. Yet another example of divine protection. Now, Musi chose Balincaran to allow the Rangers to rest. They had been awake 24 hours, marching 25 miles, including another river, the Morcan, and another major road, the Rizal Highway. The latter had to be negotiated with care as well, for it was filled with yet another Japanese convoy headed north. They were not detected. While taking the break at Balincaran, Captain Prince began to work out his plan to extract the prisoners. Colonel Musi would be in charge of getting the Rangers to the camp, but Prince would mastermind the operation. And according to Hampton Sides and Ghost Soldiers, his excellent book on the raid at Cabanatuan, Prince would oversee everything. With the help of platoon leaders, he had to figure out how to apportion the manpower and the firepower, how to choreograph the event so that bullets flew in the right direction at the right time as hundreds of men ran this way and that through the darkness, while Musi would be somewhere in the outlying grasslands watching carefully the fracas through binoculars. Prince would be where the action was, having to make all of these split-second calls. It was Musi's show in the end, but the main act, the incursion itself, was Prince's special predicament to solve or to bungle. What Prince realized is that even with these aerial photographs, he didn't have enough information to devise a solid plan of attack. He could see the buildings, but he didn't know what or who was in them. He knew where the Japanese soldiers, he knew that there were Japanese soldiers in the camp, but he didn't know how many or where they were quartered. He could see some of the guardhouses, but he didn't know if there were others, and in addition, how many pillboxes rimmed the camp. He didn't know how many tanks, if any, were in the camp, and if so, where they were located. He needed to know the location of all the fences and how many strands of barbed wire enclosed them. Where, if any, were drainage ditches and ravines that would provide cover for the advance. He needed to know the condition of the prisoners, where they were located, and how many could walk, and how many needed to be carried. They could get to Cabanatuan, but Prince didn't have enough intel to know what to do when he got there. Getting Prince the information he needed was the job of the Alamo Scouts, the 6th Army's recon unit that was created by General Kruger in 1944. Lieutenants Bill Nellist and Tom Rounceville were the Alamo squad's leaders. They were in charge of reconnoitering the camp, but because the structure was positioned on a piece of flat land that stretched for hundreds of yards, they were limited in how much information they could learn. Musi did not accept this as an excuse and ordered the men to find a way to get the information. Now let me show you the problem they had, the Alamo Scouts. This map here, I guess, is the best. Here is the camp right here. The prison camp site at Cabanatuan. I hope you can see Cabu. Yes. This is 1 mile over. There's a bridge there. There's a Japanese encampment there we'll learn about later. This is Cabanatuan City. It's about 4 miles from the prison camp. And as they cross this river, the Pampanya, as they get across that river, there's some trees here. And then it opens up into rice fields right in front of the main gate. And it's about a mile from the trees to the prison camp's front gate. And it's flat as Texas. And it's difficult to get across there without being detected. You've got to pull, at the point they enter this rice area, there are going to be over 200 men that are going to try to make that 1 mile advance. And they're going to have to do it in daylight. They want to make the attack as soon as dark occurs, around 7:30 to 7:40, and get the men out of there within 30 minutes and then make the trek back to their base camp. So the big problem they're facing is having to make the initial advance in broad daylight. And they have to make the last mile across a flat piece of land, a rice field, easily seen throughout by the guard towers at Cabanatuan's POW camp. So Lieutenants Bill Nelson and Tom Rounceville, these Alamo scouts, were given the duty to go find the information and to do it in a way that they would not be detected. Now, the detailed information they did possess presented another daunting challenge. Located just a mile north of Cabanatuan across the Cabu River Bridge, 200 Japanese soldiers were bivouacked, well-armed, and with several tanks at their disposal. The attack on the POW camp would be easily heard from that location, and therefore they must be neutralized before the extraction could go forward. It was at this point that the Rangers were joined by a surprise visitor, Captain Juan Pajota, a notorious Filipino guerrilla leader who operated throughout Nueva Ecija province and knew its every nuance topographically and politically. He actually controlled the Filipino population throughout the province in the sense of his underground activities as a guerrilla. And since all of the Filipinos didn't like the Japanese in their country, they cooperated with him on any request that he made of them. This is the citizenry. So it's important to see that the citizenry was involved in the extraction as well. They too wanted to help in any way they could to help these POWs gain freedom. and we'll see how they participated a little later in our story. But this man was a guerrilla leader. He knew the topography. He knew where the rivers were. He knew where the best places to cross were, where the areas were that they could hide and therefore take care of certain operations without being detected. And so this Juan Pajota became a very important new member of the organization. Therefore, he caused the Japanese so much trouble, they even had a price on his head. He was wanted with a bounty. Now, with the scouts off to gather more intel, Pajota informed Musi that even though his basic plan was solid, the Rangers could not make the attack that evening for three reasons. This is the evening upcoming of January 29th. That was the date that they had specified to move into the camp and free the prisoners. But Pajota says, you shouldn't do it tonight, and there are three reasons. The Japanese bivouac at Kabu River Bridge had been increased to more than 1,000 soldiers. At Kabanatuan, the usual contingent of 100 troops had been increased to 300. Finally, intel to Pajota from Kabanatuan City revealed that that night the Japanese would move a convoy north using the road that runs directly in front of the camp. Musi didn't like the way things were developing and reluctantly postponed the attack until the night of January 30th. Now, using the time to examine maps and photographs, Musi, Prince, Hosan, and Pajota discussed every possible scenario of the raid. During their exchange, the problem of excavating the prisoners became the topic. How do you carry them out? Those that can't walk or can't walk very long. Those that are bedridden. Those that are too weak. Pajota insisted that most of the men in the camp were of poor health and that a large number would not be able to walk the 25 miles to safety. Pajota turned out to be the next example of divine provision. He had lived in Nueva Ecija province all his life, and after the Japanese took Luzon, he organized a guerrilla group that opposed these insurgents. He was so respected by the local population that anything he asked of the people, they would comply. His solution was to transport the sick, decrepit, and frail out of Kabanatuan by carabao. Have a picture. These are carabao. You know them as water buffalo. They're big, they are strong, and they are slow. And the Filipinos would use them to harvest crops, as you can see. These are carts that the carabao pull. And later on, we'll run into nipa huts. These are nipa huts in the back here. And some of them are elevated, as you can see. And an elevated nipa hut will be a key factor in this story. So how are you going to get these prisoners to safety, those who can't walk very far? Well, they're going to use the carts pulled by carabao. So the carabao, then, are water buffalo. They plod along, and their drivers have to whip them and increase their pace only slightly. Very stubborn. But Pajota insisted that there was no other way to move the prisoners in an efficient manner. He promised that with the delay, he could recruit carabao hitched to as many carts as Musi thought necessary. It was agreed to recruit 12. Later on, in the afternoon of July 29th, the Rangers and the two groups of guerrillas moved out of Balancaran for the three-mile march to Platero, the barrio where Musi had selected his headquarters for the operation. There, the Alamo scouts confirmed Pajota's warning of the Japanese troop movement. They were already leaving Kabanatuan City, headed straight for the camp some 5 miles away on their excavation north. The convoy would jam the highway well into the night. The morning of January 30th found the road in front of the camp empty of traffic. The Alamo scouts were situated in the woods on the northwest side of the camp. Between them and the main gate was a mile of flat, open real estate made up of rice fields and brush. Without elevation and at such a distance, it was impossible to get a more detailed evaluation of the camp's layout, which was inside its fences and where it was located. No topographic formation that could provide elevation was anywhere close to the structure. But Lieutenant Nellis spotted a Nipa shack just to the north of the camp. It was built on stilts so that it might possibly provide a bird's eye view of the compound. The mystery, though, was how to get to it. It was decided that he and Private Rufo Vaquilla, a Filipino-American, would take the chance of walking casually over to the shack. A Filipino guerrilla was sent to bring back farmer's clothes for each of the men. Nihilist slid his M1 rifle down a pants leg, which caused him to walk with a limp, and probably making it more realistic that he was truly a farmer. The two men stepped out of the trees in full view of the guard shacks at the camp. They walked slowly and nonchalantly toward the hut, expecting at any moment to draw the attention of a guard and thus blowing the entire operation. Divine protection again prevailed. Not one effort was made to address the two farmers who made it to the shack and climbed up the bamboo ladder into a one-room outpost. Not only were they protected from detection during their trip over, but inside they were gifted with another divine provision by what they saw. The entire camp was clearly visible. Nellist could count the guards on the towers and the layout of the streets. An expert marksman with years of experience in estimating distances between rifle and targets, Nellist used his gun sight to draw a map of the compound. His estimates turned out to be right on the money. He could see all the fences and where the power and telephone lines ran. The camp, he accurately estimated, was 800 yards deep and 600 yards wide. The main road ran the entire length of the camp from the front gate to the rear. This is Camp Cabanatuan. They're located out here in a Nipa hut, and they're up elevated, it's on stilts, and they can look down into the camp and see all of the various buildings that are involved. I'll show you what they're seeing. This is the main gate here. This is the main street or thoroughfare that runs to the rear of the camp. And this is a street right here that runs left and right. What they're going to note here is where, from watching the activity inside the camp for this morning, they spent until about noon gathering information, that here is Japanese headquarters. Along in here are the enlisted men's barracks, and they stretch across the back area here. These two are barracks on this side. This area here, along in this area, also the barracks on this side of the road. And this segment right here is where the POWs are housed. You'll see right here, these little points, these indicate the pillboxes that have to be taken out. On the corners, you can see that there are guard towers. So these are things that he is observing and is making notes so that he can get this back to Musi and to Prince. And so he continues to note that most of the Japanese were quartered to the right of the main road and across the rear of the camp. To the left of the main road and at the front quarter of the camp was where the prisoners were housed. Nihilus noted that the main gate swung both in and out and was secured by a single padlock. There were three guard towers across the front and two pillboxes. 300 yards down the main street was another road running from one side of the compound to the other. On the rear right corner of this intersection, Nihilus noted a large metal building where, if tanks were inside the camp, this was where they would be located. This is where the bazookas would be aimed. Three Alamo scouts were able to make it to the shack that afternoon, get Nihilus' report, and spirit it back to Platero to the anxiously awaiting Colonel Musi and Captain Prince. they were amazed at the depth of detail Nellist had provided. With intel in hand, Prince devised his plan. The Rangers would move out toward the camp at 5 o'clock that afternoon, flanked on the north by Pahota's 200 guerrillas and Hosan's 80 to the south. Pahota was to set up an ambush at the Kabu River Bridge. One of his men was to set an explosive under the main support beam of the bridge, timed to explode at 7:40. If the bridge didn't completely collapse, then Pahota's men would cut down advancing Japanese soldiers with enfilading fire from positions on both sides of the road. Japanese attempts to use tanks to cross the river, should the bridge not collapse, were to be addressed with bazookas. Hosan's men were to set up a roadblock north of the camp to delay any Japanese troops coming up from Kabanatuan City, where about 8,000 were located. In addition, they were to cut telephone lines just before the raid began to prevent any distress calls for help coming out of the camp. The Rangers would walk through the trees, but upon entering the rice fields, they would begin a low crawl toward the main gate. About halfway to the highway, F Company would peel off to the left and go under the road through a culvert and follow a drainage ditch around to the back of the camp. These Rangers would position themselves to take out the guards on the side towers and the pillboxes below. Once in place, Lieutenant Murphy was to snipe a sentry in one of the guard towers, and the sound of his gun would ignite the operation. So F Troop, you can see, is going to come around this side. They peel off here, and they do a circular move to get around to the side and to the back of the camp. It seems like... Well, this is the best we can do. But as these men come around, they're able to note these pillboxes, and they position themselves and drain these ditches out here. They're undetected. They do this in daylight. And they take out the pillboxes and the guard towers that are around the perimeter here on the north and east side. That's F Company that's taking care of that. So the Rangers would walk through trees, but upon entering the rice fields, they would begin a low crawl toward the main gate. Now, you can see here on this particular diagram that starting right along here, this is from this little stream here, that's where the river, the woods end and the rice field begins. And they have to make that 1 mile advance in broad daylight. That's C Company under Prince that does this. It is Murphy's F Company that goes around behind. And all of this is timed for F Company to take about an hour to accomplish. And so these Rangers then would be in position at about 7:30 to take out these guard towers and pillboxes. On hearing Murphy's opening round then, the Rangers of C Company positioned at the front gate would charge the compound. The first targets would be men in the guard towers along the main road. Once neutralized, they would then break the main gate's padlock and open both sides, through which the first wave of Rangers would sprint down the main road, turn right, and begin strafing the Japanese headquarters and barracks with Thompson machine guns and Browning rifles. Next, the bazooka team would penetrate to the intersection and take out the tank shed and any tanks that were inside. Once these areas were secured, the next team would move to the prisoners' area and begin the evacuation. Once all were outside the main gate, Prince would fire a flare to indicate that the raid was over. Once all the POWs were across the Pampanga River, he would fire a second flare to allow the guerrilla teams to withdraw. Prince estimated the entire action would take 30 minutes. He described the operation as organized confusion and said, "We wanted all hell to break loose, but to break loose precisely on our terms." One major problem still concerned Musi and Prince, the mile-long belly crawl in broad daylight. Again, Pahota offered a simple but potentially effective suggestion. He explained how the Japanese were always excited, even panicked, when American planes flew over the camp. They'd run around, look up, and point until the planes were out of sight. His idea was for Musi to break radio silence and call the 6th Army headquarters and request General Kruger to dispatch some aircraft to buzz the camp in order to distract the Japanese long enough so that C Company and the scouts could make the final push to the main road undetected. Musi thought it a chance worth taking and made the call. Now we are ready for the raid. Tuesday night, January 30th, and we'll fight that battle at about 10 till the hour.